Blog Talk Radio.
You know that the ice cream scoop can make a child smile, and that by slowing us down, the traffic light can keep us going. You know that the lawnmower makes life easier, that the blood bank makes life possible. But did you know all these ideas came from the minds of African Americans? Support the United Negro College Fund, because a mind is a terrible thing to waste. Visit uncf.org or call 1-800-332-UNCF. Brought to you by UNCF and the Ad Council.
Good morning, good morning. Thank you for joining Saturday Mornings with Joy Keys. I'm your host, Joy Keys. I want to thank you so much for listening. Just want to let you know you can follow me on twitter.com/Joy Keys. You can become a fan of the show on Facebook. Just look up Saturday Mornings with Joy Keys. And today, if you have any questions or concerns, you can call in. The call-in number is 646-929-0368. I want to thank you for all your support. We're past 52,000 downloads of the podcast, and I could not have done that without your support and listening and sharing with your friends. So, again, thank you so much. This morning, I'm going to be speaking again, and I say again because he was on here before, but he was such a wonderful guest, I had to bring him back on. And I found out some great news that he is going to be the new director of the Schomburg Center for Research in Black Culture. This morning, I'll be speaking with Dr. Khalil Gibran Muhammad. Good morning, Dr. Muhammad.
Good morning, Joy. Thank you so much, and I'm very pleased to be back on the show.
For those of you who aren't familiar with him, I had Dr. Muhammad on earlier talking about a book he wrote, The Condemnation of Blackness, Race, Crime, and the Making of Modern Urban America. You definitely want to check out that podcast because that will take you to a place where you might get a little upset. You might have to sit back and cool off because he delves deep into statistics and how they were used to racialize crime in America. Let me just read some of the things they were speaking. Some critics mentioned about his book. Muhammad's book renders an incalculable service to civil rights scholarship by disrupting one of the nation's most insidious, convenient, and resilient explanatory loops. Whites commit crime, but black males are criminals. With uncommon interpretive clarity and resourceful accumulation of data, the author disentangles crime as a fact of the urban experience from crime as a theory of race in American history. This is a mandatory read, and that is David Levering Lewis, Pulitzer Prize-winning author of W.E.B. Du Bois' book. So you need to pick up a copy of this book, and if you're lucky enough, I know there were some people who won a free copy due to the generosity of Dr. Muhammad and published a free copy of the book. So that's where I left off with him. But now he has a new venture with the Schomburg Center. For those of you who aren't familiar with the Schomburg Center, it's located in New York City, the United States in New York City, and it's part of the New York Public Library. It is a leading institution of its kind. Over 80 years, the center has been collecting and preserving data about the African diaspora. So, Dr. Muhammad, let's just start at the beginning. I'm going to say it plain, and don't get offended, because
okay.
I am one of them also. I am a nerd, okay? I love to read. I love to learn. I love to find out new things. And I hate to say it, but I think you're a nerd, too.
I'm a cool nerd, so.
You're a cool nerd, yeah.
I'm a cool nerd.
No, I'm cool, too. Don't get it wrong. Don't get it wrong. I'm not crazy. I don't have the Coke bottle glasses or anything. But I get a high from learning new things, and I think that's where you are. Where did this begin, this journey, this scholarly journey, this interest in history, this interest in black culture? Where did this begin?
That's a great question. Well, I was the kind of kid, 7, 8-year-old, who could not sit anywhere waiting for any reason without a book in my hand. My mom was the kind of mother who loved to go out shopping on Saturday morning, and even if she didn't buy anything, she might spend 8 hours in department stores. That was just what made her happy. It gave her joy at the end of a long work week. And so I was accustomed at a very young age to just carrying a book around and, you know, passing time. It was in that day long before iPod touches and iPads and DSs and any number of small handheld devices that could entertain you. And so I think my interest in reading and passion for learning was cultivated just in the sort of weekly routine of hanging out with mom. But more specifically, it was actually in college when I became aware of larger debates about the history of black people in this country, contemporary debates at the time about the culture wars and affirmative action and whether black people should be on elite college campuses. As you well know, I went to the University of Pennsylvania right there in West Philadelphia.
Mm-hmm.
And,
mm-hmm.
It was a really tumultuous time for black Penn students over the years that I was there. And it was really out of that experience that compelled me to learn much more about freedom struggles in the past and to really feel empowered by history so that I could face the challenges of the future. I could look people in the eye who told me that you don't belong here, you're not qualified. I never wanted to feel inadequate or unprepared to defend my right to be somewhere. And it was really out of that Penn experience that compelled me to decide to leave corporate America. I was a public accountant for a couple of years right out of school. But within 2 weeks of joining Deloitte & Touche right there in Center City, I decided that I'm going to go to graduate school and get a PhD in African-American history. And it took 22 months to make that happen. But I was committed to it, and here I am.
So now, you know, most people, and this is a very general comment, neither one of us, I believe, I don't believe this statement, but and I know you don't. You know, African-American males are going to end up in jail. They're going to end up selling drugs. They're not going to take care of their families. African-American males only want to be basketball players. African-American males only want to be football players. African-American males can't read. What do you have to say to any of these statements?
Well, I have to say that part of what you're saying is a consequence of debates and rhetoric that have been deployed for most of the last 150 years to justify racial inequality in this country. So on one hand, we have these statistics and these conversations about black males because they were founded and invented 150 years ago to substantiate why black people shouldn't have freedom, first of all, and secondarily, once they got freedom at the end of slavery, why they shouldn't have the right to vote, or why they shouldn't have access to the same quality public education as their white counterparts. And so in many ways, we've been building databases. We've been looking for the behavior of black men and women to justify and substantiate racial inequality. Fast forward to the present, many people listening now will say, well, but isn't it true that black men are in prison? Isn't it true that they are selling drugs? Isn't it true that they don't aspire to greatness? And you could say that, on one hand, yes, those realities are all around us. We see them. We can confirm them. But on another hand, we have to step back and say, well, what are we missing in this equation? What are white males in similarly situated circumstances, oftentimes on the outskirts of cities, not embedded within the city, but just beyond the media market, just beyond the gaze of urban police forces? There are reams of data that tell us that drug consumption in and of itself is not monopolized by black people, that in fact, federal statistics show us that whites and blacks consume drugs at the same rate proportionate to their population, mm-hmm. which is to mm-hmm. say that the vast majority of black men who are in prison, that awful dreaded statistic that we hear so much about, are there for nonviolent drug offenses, but black people are not consuming drugs at the rate to substantiate their nearly 50% representation in prison, which tells us then that the gaze of white America, the production of knowledge or the data record-keeping about what black people do is discriminatory. It doesn't focus on white people in the same way that it does us. So, therefore, we have swaths of white America that are engaging in similar behavior, but no one's talking about it and no one's going to prison as a result of it. And so we have to be very mindful as black people about how we continue to substantiate and reinforce those very practices that continue to reproduce inequality in our society.
I'm glad that you said that last part because we have to, I think, reflect, and we as African Americans, I'm an African American, what can we, you know, you're a father, what can fathers say to their young children to get them not to believe, to not to ingest this, I guess, half information? You know, this narrow scope of information, but to be thirsty for more information, such as yourself or such as myself, what can parents or fathers say to their children to be a catalyst to their kids?
Yeah, that's a great
thirst for knowledge.
No, that's a great question. I think it really does start with giving people a sense of who they are and where they came from. I've been talking a lot about Black History. It's Black History Month. And one of the things that I always talk about is that civil rights activists used the lessons of their predecessors. So we're talking about people in the 1960s who were talking about what their parents experienced in the 1920s or the 1930s and pretty much explained how segregation came to shape and define Black people's experiences. So those civil rights activists in the 1960s were looking to young people, to 12-year-olds and 13-year-olds, and they were saying, look, you live under these conditions not because it is something innate in you or in me. It is because we live in a society that has oppressed Black people. And those civil rights activists tell us today that children's eyes lit up with understanding, that they, in a sense, came to see themselves as bigger than their circumstances. What I'm concerned about today is that we often discard history as a source of empowerment, that we don't talk to our kids about how this country came to be, because on one hand we think, well, it's a terrible story, it's depressing, and who's going to feel good about themselves after you tell them that? But that is precisely a consequence of neoconservatism over the last 20 or 30 years. The notion that somehow talking about Black history is itself either divisive or racist or creates a cult of victimology, which there are a lot of Black people who believe that we sort of carry this entitlement to victimhood. That's all new. If you asked Black people at historically Black colleges two generations ago in the 1940s, 50s, 60s, what did Black history mean to them, there would be tremendous pride both in overcoming and surviving the struggle. But you can't talk about survival until you talk about the barriers, because otherwise what are you surviving?
That's the key right there. Overcoming, Dr. Muhammad, overcome, that's the key word right there that I think in telling the history, looking back, first of all, one, if you don't know your history, whatever the history is, you're going to repeat it.
Right.
These things that are happening right now, I personally believe, and this is just through my scholarly study of our economy, the government, the resistance, the revolutions that are going on around the globe, we've been here before. This is not new.
That's right.
Things are constantly repeating itself, but you don't know that. You think it's new. You think, oh, we want to go back to the good old days, you know, when things were great and you know, people couldn't walk around and use the same bathroom. We forgot about that part. This has happened before. You know, people's jobs have been lost. Industries have broken down, you know, all kinds of things. But if you don't know the history, then you're going to repeat. And also, you're not going to realize how far you've come, I think. But let's talk about, real quickly, you're working on a new book. We talked about Prohibition. We're mentioning just briefly about Prohibition. But you're working on the new book. Talk to me about that.
Sure. Well, the new book the working title is called Disappearing Acts, The End of White Criminality in the Age of Jim Crow. And I'm trying to do precisely what I talked about at the beginning of this conversation, which is to recover the history of white male criminality, to put it back in conversation with our contemporary understanding of crime and punishment. I mean, when we talk about crime and punishment today, we almost never mention the fact that of the 2.5 million people in prison, 1 million of them are white men, that the reality is that the incarceration rates for white men have gone up roughly equivalent to the rates of black men. It's just proportionately the numbers have completely reversed. In 1970, roughly 70% of the nation's prisoners were white. By comparison today, about 70% are black and brown, that is African American and Latino. So as a historian, part of what I'm trying to do is to recover what is this history of white criminality and how did we get to a point where they could literally disappear from the conversation about crime in this country? Is it because they all of a sudden embrace law-abidingness and civic responsibility and no longer break laws? Or is it because there's something about our criminal justice system that redirected its resources to deal with what many call the civil rights blowback? That is to say, as black people challenged, in the same way that on the streets of Bahrain, of Tunisia, of Egypt, of Libya, people are fighting back against oppression and demanding justice and equality, they're being criminalized or murdered outright. And so civil rights activists became the focus of the criminal justice system in the 1960s. And although we don't
FBI
think about
probes, all kinds of things.
That's
that,
right.
You know, constantly following them around, planning things, planning individuals. I mean, this happens all over the globe. I was recently reading Nelson Mandela's autobiography, And it's just funny, everything that was happening to him through his struggle over in South Africa was happening, you know, here to our civil rights. So that's why reading is so important, literacy is so important, education is so important, because if you don't know that, you know what, it was happening over in Brazil, it was happening in South Africa, it's
right.
happening in Egypt, it's happening in you know, all over the globe, even in Asian cultures. If you don't know that people are using similar tactics, then you're just going to repeat, you're going to fall into the trap.
That's
so
right.
I constantly implore parents to read to their children, to take them to the bookstores, to get them involved in education so that they can find out what's going on. Really funny story real quick, talking about education. My daughter was talking about the history that she's learning now in high school, and that she said, Mom, I've been learning the same history since I was in elementary school.
Mm-hmm.
It's just in a different package.
Mm-hmm.
This is my 16-year-old child telling me this. That she is learning the same history, regurgitated, but in a slightly different package. She said, Mom, why can't we talk more about the Spanish-American War? Why can't we talk about South America? How come we don't talk about Israel and Palestine? This is my 16-year-old telling this. You know how proud I was.
Well, you know,
I'm
not surprised, given who her mom is. So. But, you know, you raise a very good point. So I've been teaching at the college level full-time for 6 years, and I taught 10 years ago as a graduate student. And one of the things that's very clear is that we really do underprepare young people at the primary and secondary level for what history actually is. We give them dates and events. We celebrate progress at every turn. It's kind of like starting with the tragedy of Civil War with Abraham Lincoln freeing slaves. And at that point, we start to get it right. And we miss not only all of the nuance of slavery that tells us something about the economic foundation of this country. There is no American empire without slavery. Point of fact,
right.
Indisputable. So unless we start to teach children that the drive for profit is often paved by the road of human exploitation, then they're confused about what the global economy looks like and why people around the world who are, in a sense, the raw materials for multinational corporations and their success, they won't understand that, and they'll just sign up like the rest of them. And, you know, I'm not necessarily suggesting that we don't have to play along with this system. It is what it is. But to be informed about the economic foundations of those countries and the tendency to see people as raw materials rather than as human beings is an
mm-hmm.
important lesson that all of us should learn, particularly if we are freedom-loving people and care about people's humanity.
Definitely, definitely. Well, let's talk a little bit about the Schomburg. We have a few minutes. I want to talk about the different collections. Tell us different artifacts, manuscripts. Talk to me a little bit about the different things that are available to people at the Schomburg Center.
Sure. Well, as you've already described, the Schomburg Center is the leading repository for manuscript collections, photographs, visual art. Taken in its whole, it has about 20 million items related to the global black experience. It just celebrated this past January its 85th anniversary, and the history that represents the institution itself is tied inextricably to the foundations of the academic study of black history and the annual celebrations of black history. We haven't been talking much about it, but Carter G. Woodson's founding of Black History Week in 1926 shares the exact same anniversary as the founding of the Schomburg Center. And both of those men were part of the New Negro Movement that we generally learn about through the Harlem Renaissance. Of course, the people of that generation were, in a sense, the second generation of college-educated, professional degree-holding black people who used their skills to raise the visibility of black people so that the world would know that black people had the voices, the spirit, the soul, and the ability to engage the world on its terms and to contribute to the world just like any other race of people. And so Arthur Schomburg or Arturo Schomburg, as well as Carter G. Woodson,
mm-hmm.
were part of that moment and helped to create the legacy that I am inheriting as the director of the Schomburg. The Schomburg has Langston Hughes's papers, Richard Wright, Zora Neale Hurston, now Maya Angelou. It has artwork of Aaron Davis. It has church records of Abyssinian, the famous church of the base of Adam Clayton Powell's political leadership. It has a tremendous treasure trove of resources that are the raw materials of scholarly and artistic production. People come there both to write books, to write scholarly articles, but they also come there to be inspired, to write poetry, to write novels, to create documentary films. For example, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, the Hall of Fame basketball star, is himself a historian, has written 7 books, and one of his most recent books has now been turned into a documentary film capturing the greatness of the first professional black basketball team that also happens to be the first basketball team to win the world championship of basketball, the Harlem Renaissance or the Harlem Wrens. That documentary has recently premiered, and it's called On the Shoulders of Giants. And Kareem Abdul-Jabbar credits both Howard Dotson, the current director, and the resources of the Schomburg for being able to tell their story. They were never admitted into the NBA as late as 1948 when they finally disbanded. So it's stories like that that can not only speak to our young people, that fathers can pass on to their children. Do you know the history of basketball playing?
Right.
Do you know who the Jackie Robinsons are of basketball, a sport that has become identified as America's black sport? And those stories can be told by virtue of the resources that the Schomburg has been collecting for 85 years.
Also, I want to mention that you guys have a wonderful Summer Institute program and a Scholars in Residence program. People can go to the website. I'll put a link on my page, but there's a wonderful program of it open to they offer 6-week sessions for 10 rising seniors entering their 5 will be selected from colleges and universities in New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut, and 5 from historical black colleges and universities across the nation. So to learn more about that, check out their website. I'll post the link on the fan page and also on here on the blog talk page. The deadline for the application, it says March 21st. So there's still time if you're interested. Again, this is a 6-week session that the Schomburg Center for Research in Black Culture is offering. So please check that out or pass along the information to someone that you know. We talked a little bit about some global issues, and just briefly, we only have a couple minutes left. What do these global uprisings, how can African-Americans somehow connect with this? What is the relationship between African-Americans and the uprising in Egypt, the uprisings in other parts that are just springing, boom, 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 like wildfire all over? How does this relate to African-Americans, or does it relate to African-Americans?
Well, it does relate because we are global citizens. So to the extent that we as individuals take ownership of what is happening in the world, we are absolutely accountable to those events. Not to mention, of course, that as these events touch North Africa, the birthplace not only of humanity, but also a critical source of learning and inspiration that Africans contributed to the world many, many centuries and millennia ago, it is crucial that African Americans see this part of the world as an important part of how we engage. Not to mention, of course, that many of these countries not singularly are Islamic, but we also have to remember that many in the black community are Muslims and see the Middle East as a source of religious pride, that it is crucial to who they are as religious people. Now, that being said, I think that in terms of the politics of this moment, African Americans can also bring not only a source of responsibility to what their civil rights activism has meant for people who rise up against government, who claim the right to participate fully in a society. Some of the concerns that are being expressed by the United States government now in supporting the universal right to peacefully assemble, the right to protest, and the right to demonstrate, of course, must ring somewhat ironically in the ears of African Americans today, because, again, as I said earlier, it was precisely
those actions that were oppressed. You know,
that's right. So it's somewhat ironic, you know, that the United States government kicked and screamed at every turn, sending troops down not to allow African Americans in to protect, but in fact to help suppress. Now, the federal government had a different role than state government, so let me clarify that. But the point is, protest itself has always been subject to repression, the right to speak up and to claim. And so in this instance, the United States looks as the sort of bastion of freedom and liberty. But we know even to this day that protest traditions are often subject to great controversy. We had similar problems with Rudolph Giuliani in the 1990s around African American youth trying to protest around police brutality, a theme that of course brings all of this conversation together. And so I think African Americans want to be mindful and supportive of those rights, but also not let this country simply trumpet its own traditions of freedom and liberty without bringing a critical edge to that conversation. And finally, I'd just say that there have been signs echoing the civil rights legacy, I Have a Dream, Million Man March. Those tropes and terms that, of course, are meaningful in this context have inspired others to claim their own right to participate. And so we should be proud of young people around the globe demanding to participate in their societies to end repressive rules and regimes in their countries.
Definitely. Well, I want to thank you so much, Dr. Muhammad, for coming on this morning. As always, it's been a wonderful pleasure to have you on. I wish you much success with the Schomburg Center appointment and finishing out this year at Indiana University. And I'm sure we'll come back on when you finish your new book.
Well, I hope that might be a while, so I hope we get another chance. But it's really an honor to be on the show, and I look forward to perhaps seeing you in Philadelphia and at an event in the future.
Definitely. Thank you so much. You have a wonderful Saturday.
Take care. You too.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. Thank you, everybody, for listening this morning. That was Dr. Khalil Gibran Muhammad, a wonderful scholar just appointed as the new director of the Schomburg Center for Research in Black Culture. If you're not aware of what the Schomburg Center is, please check out the link. I'll post that on Blog Talk Radio and also on the fan page. But it's been around for more than 80 years collecting the history of Africans around the globe. Next, I'm going to have a wonderful, beautiful, talented singer, Ayo. She's live from France in a couple of minutes. So you want to stay tuned. The call in number is 646-929-0368. And next week at 12 p.m. Eastern, a special time, be speaking with Ava DuVernay and actress Nicole White at 12 p.m. Eastern about a new film, I Will Follow. You can follow me on twitter.com/joykeys. You can become a fan on Facebook. Just look up Saturday Mornings with Joy Keys. You can also email me. Just send an email to SaturdaysWithJoyKeys@hotmail.com. Have a beautiful Saturday.
You know that the ice cream scoop can make a child smile, and that by slowing us down, the traffic light can keep us going. You know that the lawnmower makes life easier, that the blood bank makes life possible. But did you know all these ideas came from the minds of African Americans? Support the United Negro College Fund, because a mind is a terrible thing to waste. Visit uncf.org or call 1-800-332-UNCF. Brought to you by UNCF and the Ad Council.